Very much. At this stage, I would like to invite all our speakers to come up here. We will squeeze you in at this table here. It will be a little tight, but there are a couple of other chairs we'll bring forward. So please, could all of our speakers come forward at this time? So, ladies and gentlemen, this is your chance now. I know you've been waiting very patiently, haven't had a chance to ask questions, so I know you're not going to disappoint me. I see we have at least two mics out there. I don't know if we're restricted to asking questions from the mics. It doesn't matter to me, but perhaps the organizers want to record your questions. I would also remind you that you don't have to restrict yourself to questions. You can also, you might wish to make a comment, add something to what you've heard, or whatever. So, who would like to kick it off? Yes, do you want to use a mic? And if you'd like, maybe line up behind the mics, and we can be really organized. I must say that Marilyn has done a wonderful job here with her signs. You know, you have the 2 minutes, and then if you miss the 2 minutes, you have the big stop sign, and so kind of scary. But go ahead, please.
Thank you very much.
And if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself, and then with your question or comment.
Yes, thank you very much. My name is Marco Ferroni. I'm with Syngenta Foundation for Sustainable Agriculture. And I have a very simple question for Mr. Gopalakrishnan, but I want to preface the question by congratulating the panel and the chairs of this panel. Those were excellent presentations, and thank you very much. So my question is, of course, Mr. Gopalakrishnan, I think that you made a very strong and very justified pitch by asking for or calling for more investment in surface water storage. What I did not hear you refer to was the question of water subsidies and power subsidies. I'm an economist, and therefore I tend to think in terms of incentives, including misaligned incentives. And I think that surely the subsidization issue, which in India was is constantly in the press, it's also in the international press, is a major issue, and I would have thought that that would have deserved some mention. Thank you very much.
Great, thank you.
Well, thank you for that very interesting question. When it comes to subsidizing water, especially for water for food or water for agriculture, it is quite complex. In fact, there is no global accepted norms when we want to look into this subsidy. And what one could think of is cost recovery, at least partially. And this is where the efforts are always on at least to recover the cost towards the operation and maintenance. But I think the good solution is going to come from the participatory management approach, in which the entire systems are going to be handed over to the Water Users Association, and there may be a better propensity to pay for the water charges, because as of now, there is still many schemes are being managed in government, and we are not in a position to give assured water supply at the right time, and that is hindering the cost recovery, and the subsidy is automatically then inevitable for the governments to provide.
Okay, thank you. We have a question here, and by the way, I've been told that you have to use the mics because your words of wisdom are being recorded, and if you're away from the mic, they will not be heard. So please go ahead.
Yeah, this is Mushtaq Ahmed with CEDA Canada in Ottawa, Abdi. And the question refers both to Mr. Victor Dukvani for his presentation and Mr. Gopalakrishnan. Victor presented a very good evidence, some issues that actually affecting the water in the Central Asian context, how the dams have been created withdrawal of water beyond its capacity, leading to drying up of lakes, overuse, and then due to O&M situation, probably bad governance, the water supply hasn't been steady, the productivity has gone down. Mr. Gopalakrishnan has talked about water management in the context of linking rivers, how in the Indian context, how bulk water transfer might help them. But what about the what Mr. Victor has mentioned about right to water issue, like right to food, right to education, right to life? What about the littoral countries? What will happen to them? Because as an upper riparian countries, if your bulk withdrawal of water will affect the food security of others, so your security might jeopardize the insecurity or create insecurity, food insecurity for others. So what do you have to say in this context?
Thank you for that interesting questions. It is, in fact, one of the burning issues even within a country. What you try to indicate cross-cutting in all the transboundary issues, even within a country, between provinces, there are at times this question of sharing the available water resources. The market could play a role of trying to get the best out of the use of water. And when I was trying to indicate about the long-distance water transfer or interlinking or interbasin transfer, whatever you would like to call it, I also linked it with the word cooperation. And when I tried to introduce in the last two slides about this cooperation, it is regional cooperation cutting across the countries. Perhaps the global climate change, the likely impact due to that, especially on the Himalayan glaciers, and the entire 9 to 10 countries surrounding the Himalayas, it includes China, India, and others, it is going to really affect the rabi crop or the wheat production, maybe after 20, 30 years. And the storage is going to at least ensure the rabi crops or the dry season crop during winter. And this is possible only when there is cooperation, and whatever could enhance the opportunities for cooperation, reduce conflicts, it would serve itself. I am sure that we are going to make progress, and the climate change sometimes it has given a new opportunity for people to come together. And India especially has a lot to do, even within the country, especially the peninsular India has no other types of problem. Even there are problems between the states or the provinces. And this is now getting solved by the direct dialogue of the participating farmers between the upper and lower regions, showing a clear understanding. And instead of allocating water per se, what is the benefit that the river could provide and can we share it and get the best out of it? This is coming into the minds of the people.
Yeah, thank you. We have to remember that even in Canada and most of the Western countries, we don't have a bulk transboundary water transfer. We don't do that. So that's an important consideration we should keep in mind. Thank you.
No, I will try to add to Mr. Gopalakrishna some my view. At first, the right of water for end water user should be definite and accompanied by the long way from the transboundary water up to the through all line of water hierarchy, through national system, the regional, provincial system, and later for the local authority. From this point, I think that we must to speak not only about the water rights, but also about the system of water governance. Because the system of water governance, it should be the combination of legal the framework on the transboundary water. It is, should be legal framework for the national law, and simultaneously it should be the proper system of implementation which based on the institutional approach. Institutional approach, what we now the, started to implement, as I mentioned in Fergana Valley, it is a system of combined private the government partnership, which based on the water user association on the low level, on the next level of water hierarchy, we organize the committee of canal system, which include as a managing the part, the representative of this water user association. But in any case, government should be the principal participant, supporter, and initiator of all this, the work, which should the connect all this relation by the proper financial and economic tools. Most difficult it is the organize transboundary cooperation. But transboundary cooperation, it's only one, should base on the goodwill of leader, and our role of as a water specialist to support them by the proper tools. We use in our work, for example, on between the five states, we use common training system, common information system, common implementation of integrated water resource management project and automatization project, yes, which creates the single understanding and consensus between the different partner, which will step by step formulate also and pressure to the top level. So it is not very easy, maybe very complicated task, but we need to go on this way if we want to survive before the face of future water scarcity.
Thank you. Question here.
Yeah, my name is Patrick Cornway. I'm a graduate student at Yale studying plant biology. And I have a question for Dave Conley. So I've always been interested in agricultural biotechnology and the potential it has for crop improvement, and also by the public acceptance of those technologies. And I have a question just about how, to what extent do you see biotechnology impacting aquaculture and its development, and to what extent do you see public, issues with public acceptance?
Are you talking about genetically modified?
That's the main biotechnology I have in mind. If there's more, then I'd be interested in hearing about those as well.
Biotechnologies, vaccine development is one, and there's a whole host of other things. I think the GMO debate is, as you know, is two sides disagreeing about a perspective. So what's the future of it? I think it's anybody's guess. When people are starving, somebody's going to come ahead and try and do something. The debate here over GMOs is I don't think it's based on science. It's more based on a perspective about where you want humanity to go. And I think that's a very personal thing.
Okay. Would any other member of the panel like to comment on this question? No, if not, thank you. Yes.
Thank you. Kent Feschel from the Canadian Permanent Mission in Rome. I have a couple of questions for Mr. Adam. But first wanted to thank the entire panel for a very interesting start to the discussion. Of note was that in addition to talking about crop production, fisheries production, land and water management, in addressing food security, there are many comments, discussion about the importance of education, health, infrastructure, credit, addressing population pressures, investment in human resources, all of which served as a very useful reminder that we need a multi-sectoral approach to development in order to address the food security challenges. And now the quick questions, Mr. Adam, you did talk quite a bit. You were one of those that focused on education and literacy rates and such. Ghana, the Ghanaian government, gets quite a bit of credit internationally for its investment in access to education, and a part of that is a very large school feeding program. And I'd be interested in hearing your perspectives from a food insecure, poor part of Ghana about the impact of school feeding on food security in the communities that you're most familiar with. And also, you made a quick comment about Jatropha competing for arable land. I'd be interested in knowing why, in that one hears a lot of excitement about Jatropha precisely because it's able to grow in degraded lands or land that's marginal lands that aren't used for agricultural production. So in your area, what are the specific causes that lead it to be competing for arable land? Thank you.
Thank you very much for your question. Actually, one of the issues that the government, Ghana government, is doing to tackle education is in the field of the school feeding program. Now, for the first year, they have actually piloted some schools. And in my district, for instance, the first year, only two schools were piloted, where a meal is given to each of the students in those schools. Then the second year, they have increased the number of schools to six per district. And actually, one of the impacts of this program is the increase in enrollment that we are now seeing in the schools. So I think the subsequent years, there are intentions of the government to expand to other schools, especially in the rural areas. So it's a very good program. Now, in the case of the JETROFA, we have realized that JETROFA has been touted as an alternative to biodiesel production. Now, what we are saying, in our area, about 20,000 hectares of land, not marginal lands, but arable lands, are being used for the cultivation of this JETROFA. Now, we are thinking that as an alternative source of fuel, maybe it's going to bring down the cost of fuel or the prices of fuel in the home market. But what we realize is that studies have shown that this JETROFA, the biodiesel, is sold at twice the price as biodiesel in foreign markets. So for investors who are after profits, we feel that it will be unwise to cultivate, produce the biodiesel, and sell it in the country when we can make twice the profit that we can in the foreign markets. So basically, the biodiesel that we think that is going to bring down prices in the country is never going to bring down prices in the country because it's going to be an export commodity and sold in foreign markets. So the lands that are taken over, the arable lands that are taken over, are actually lands lost to food production. Thank you very much. Okay,
thank you. Question here.
There's been no documented evidence of Atlantic salmon and Pacific co-breeding or interbreeding. It's they're two different species, so the definition would preclude that. The environmental impacts of aquaculture are controversial and probably could take an entire conference. The problem is that when it's practiced close into shore, there are some documented problems as we move further offshore, which is, I think, where the future is going. We get away from that. The future that I see is that aquaculture will be done in the open ocean. The University of New Hampshire farms 12 miles off the coast with an experimental design they have. Mississippi State did an experiment in the Gulf of Mexico 22 miles off the coast. This is out of anybody's backyard or front yard, for that matter. So I think the environmental impacts will be kind of a non-story at that point. The technology is obviously changing, and people are cognizant of the fact that when you're doing something in that kind of environment, you have to be careful. So that's why what we talk about is responsible aquaculture, which is to be aware of what you're doing and what happens and try to mitigate it. This is why they're working on this integrated multitrophic aquaculture, is to more or less design a system like a natural system where one animal's waste is another animal's nutrient or another plant's nutrient, so that we actually do what is the most effective and efficient way to do it. The problem there is the regulations will not allow you to farm salmon, mussels, and seaweeds. This had to be to get special approval to do this. So, in fact, it's the regulations that are preventing people from doing intelligent things.
You're okay with that? Yes. Question here.
Hi, I'm Kirk Godreau, PhD student out of Waterloo. I have a quick question for Dave Connolly. Just to build off that last question, I was just wondering what kind of international oversight there is for aquaculture, because if it will be so far offshore sometimes. And I also have a quick question for the whole group. There were some mentions of population predictions, and I feel that at a food security conference, I was wondering what the interaction is between projected food security and projected population, and how accurate you feel that the population projections are based on food security numbers.
Okay, so Dave, maybe if you handle the first one, and then we'll ask the panel that would like to comment on the balance between food security and population growth.
The offshore aquaculture will take place in the 200-mile exclusive economic zones, so they are the jurisdiction of those countries. In the United States, for example, it's state jurisdiction out to about 3 miles, and then beyond that, it's federal. So I would anticipate that it's going to be a federal policy and regulatory environment that will rule that, and this is what the United States is doing, trying to get their aquaculture bill passed. For other places in the world, again, this is a young industry. It only goes back about 40 years in the modern era, which we would call modern aquaculture. So it's really a new and evolving thing, and a lot of the regulatory environments were not constructed around aquaculture. They were for fishing, and even Canada's own fishing regulations just kind of add-ons for aquaculture. We have no Aquaculture Act in this country.
Okay, so the second part of that question was relating to the balance between food production and population growth. Who would like to comment?
I step in to address that question because being one of the largest populated country, next only to China now, but going to exceed that within 2 more decades, I will attempt an answer for your interesting question. There have been a lot of efforts to control population, but only we can have a lesser rate of growth of population, but at least we have to factor something of the order of 1.5 to 2% in most of the developing world. When I try to say the developing world, I know Nigeria's population was only 60 million about 3-4 decades back, and in the presentation I found it is now as much as 100 and odd. You know, these are the trends which are very difficult. Even specific programs in countries like India 4 decades back, it failed. So it requires a lot of convincing, and when we accept that, we have to come to the other side of it. How do we ensure the food security for this population? And it is there that we have a lot of interesting cross-linkages between many things, including land, water, food production capacity, the role of science and technology, and the global trade. So all these are having, there are many drivers, and the new driver that stepped in since last few years is the discernible global climate change and its possible impact. And this is where we have to think of quite a few things. GM is one solution. Many of the agricultural present practices, we have to relook into it, and also the global trade. But global trade itself cannot be a panacea for some of the problems that we encounter, especially with regard to very large populated areas like China and India. For instance, when I said India produces about 230 million tons of grains, a 10% shortage means 23 million tons, and this cannot be overnight turned over to that part, even from global efforts. So some of these cases, they have to ensure that the productivity is at least taking care of about 90 to 95% of the demand.
Anybody else like to comment?
I'd like to comment here that it's true the population of Nigeria is rising very fast, and this requires that food production must increase in order to cope with the rising population. And large-scale farming which we have now introduced in Nigeria, is going to help a bit in combating food scarcity. Because in Nigeria, we depend on the smallholder farmer who supplies the amount of food which we are consuming. But with the adoption of large-scale farming, we think this is going to improve the situation a bit. Let me also use this opportunity to comment on biotechnology and the use of GMO. Well, this varies from country to country, and in Nigeria, we are rather cautious about it, but what Parliament is doing in Nigeria is to debate a legislation, a law on biosafety use of GMOs. This is really taking a very long time because precaution must be taken so that the introduction of a GMO does not bring untold health problems. So regulations or establishment or law to really make sure that the use of GMO is a safety valve rather than a poisonous technology is being cautiously approached. But I think it has a lot of place, but we have to do it very, very cautiously.
Thank you. Now, I've been handed a note saying that we have to end at 4 p.m. Now, I'm working on Mountain Standard Time, so that would give us about 2 hours and a certain... But you meant in about 5 minutes, I take it. Oops. We have a question here. So we're winding down. So if you have one last, maybe we'll take a couple of more questions and we'll wind down. Yes.
Yes. This is the Vice Chancellor from Nigeria. I heard from your paper how the government has very good initiatives and 200 billion naira, and up to 100 something of that has been accessed by farmers. Now, my worry or my concern is when this begins to yield fruit and there's much food production, what are the plans? I also heard you mention about processing and preservation. Processing, actually, yes. What, when it begins to yield fruit and we have so much of food produced, what are the plans towards preservation of some of these products that are rather easily perishable? You did mention something about preservation, yes, but and that also that your university and others are having researches into preservation. What about patenting this one so that we can have these products in the market? Like we see, most of the products we find around in our shelves are from other countries, and not so many of them are in the Nigerian market, are not made from the Nigerian market. What are the plans towards that, sir?
Okay, thank you.
The introduction of the Commercial Agricultural Credit Scheme, as I earlier said, has been floated 200 billion and 156 billion has already been approved. It is anticipated that when the large-scale commercial farmers go into this, there will certainly be a lot of food production. But in order to add value to the production, preservation, processing, and storage are very, very vital. And in this regard, as I earlier said in my presentation, various industries have been set up, especially for rice and cassava, where these products will be processed and preserved. Because if you leave them in their raw forms, like you said, they're going to perish. But many of these industries are going to come up through private partnership arrangement. In other words, we in Nigeria have a lot of opportunities for private people to come and invest in order to develop some of these preservation, storage, and processing industries which are on ground and which have been planned. So I don't have much fears about massive production of food, because if the private sector is adequately attracted, then they can set up these processing industries. So the question really becomes, how do you get the private sector attracted in order to invest? I think that is a different subject matter altogether. And we are still talking about attracting investors to invest privately. And for us, people who are coming from foreign land, I think security is very, very important, security of a country. You would have heard over the television and networks that we have had a little bit of problem of insecurity within the Niger Delta area. And as I said, Mr. President has done an excellent job for granting amnesty to our brothers and sisters who were aggrieved because of underdevelopment. They have now surrendered their arms and they have embraced peace. Therefore, security is assured in Nigeria now. The threat that arose because of kidnapping and so on has very, very, very much reduced. This will now give an opportunity to foreign investors to come and invest in agriculture, especially in the areas of processing, preservation, and storage.
Thank you. Final question here.
Thank you. René Roy, graduate student from McGill University in Agricultural Economics. My question is for Mr. Conley, related to inland aquaculture. I would like to know what is the importance of inland aquaculture, and also what is, and second question is, what will be the consequences or impact on aquaculture related to climate changes? Thank you.
Are you talking about in our country, in Canada?
Yes. Or in more general?
Well, I think that freshwater aquaculture has a significant role to play. We don't do a heck of a lot of it here, but there are other parts of the world. China, for example, does a tremendous amount of freshwater aquaculture with a lot of carp and other kinds of species. Southeast Asia, and I would think Africa is going to begin. We had someone today talk about 50-hectare farms going in, so this is going to be in fresh water, I'm sure. So I would imagine that is going to be a significant producer. I believe India has tremendous potential and is thinking about gearing up for that. So again, yes, I think it has a tremendous opportunity and certainly a role to fill in producing food. A lot of people depend on fish protein. It may be the only protein in their diet in some parts of the world. We're rather fortunate here. And the other question, I don't know.
It was related to climate change and the effect on aquaculture, because we know it's not the... Well, there is some questions about inflow, but for a sea it's not the same thing, because the inflow, the change in length will not... be that great, but what kind of other impact will have on the aquaculture?
This would be climate change you're specifically concerned about. Well, obviously, as it gets warmer, I know a lot of the northern areas are going to be heavily impacted in Canada because the species, I don't think, are going to be able to adapt as readily. But then there's a positive side of that. They're actually seeing Pacific salmon coming to spawn in the Mackenzie River. And for people that have lived up there their entire lives, this is completely new. They've never seen that happen before. So like anything, there are certain species which are very adaptable and will exploit these new opportunities, and there are other ones which will suffer because of it because they can't readily adapt. So it's like anything. There's positive and there's negative.
Okay, and I'm afraid we'll have to cut it off there. I would like, before I thank our speakers, to make an announcement. At 5 p.m. this evening, there's the public lecture at the Centre Mount Royal, and so I know that many of you will want to take that in, and that's why we have to stop at this time. And so at this time, I would also like you to join with me in thanking our speakers. You've brought lots of good knowledge, information, and sharing with us, so thank you. And also thanks to Marilyn for keeping us on time. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Okay.